Double crop systems are really a system to where we get to take advantage of weather that allows for us to harvest two crops in a year. And depending on kind of what you determine by harvest and kind of how you determine what a year is, you know, you can see this work in various places that maybe wouldn't call it a double crop or whatnot, but a bulk majority of the time you're talking about a harvest of two grain crops. So actually pulling grain off at two different times a year, typically in two different seasons. So in Oklahoma or basically around the United States, the primary double crop system is going to be a winter small grain. So that normally is a wheat, but it could be an oat or a rye or a triticale or anything like that. And then we come in with a summer crop, typically soybean.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com. Grow a carbon crop below your row crop. Add carbon to your balance sheet with Loam Bio.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Leo Bastos, Assistant Professor of Integrative Precision Agriculture at the University of Georgia. Today, we welcome our guest, Dr. Josh Lofton. He is an Extension Cropping Systems Specialist and Associate Professor at Oklahoma State University. And I also learned he's a fellow podcaster as well. So that's a fun one to have in our podcast today. Josh, welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show. It's really great to have you here with us today. And to start things off, I just want to ask you if you can share with us a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are today.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. I do appreciate the opportunity to come and talk, talk and talk about very unique things to somebody I've never met before. So it was great to meet you as we were kind of starting this up. But yeah, as you said, my name is Josh Lofton. I'm at Oklahoma State University. And I'm an extension specialist working mainly with like crop rotations and non-traditional crops for Oklahoma systems. I'm an original Okie. I was born and raised here in Oklahoma. Got my bachelor's and my master's here at Oklahoma State University. My master's work was working in winter canola with Chad Gotze. So as we were starting winter canola here in Oklahoma, was working with him and Tom Pieper to get kind of all that started. Once I finished my degree, I went to Louisiana State University, worked with Dr. Brenda Tabagna, an old Bill Ron grad student. So worked in cane, sugar cane and rice, looking at sensor management and soil fertility management of mainly sugar cane. But we dabbled in basically all the crops in Louisiana, but really focused a lot of our time on cane and rice. Upon finishing my degree, I took another position at LSU as a assistant professor up in the Northeast District, up in the Delta region of Louisiana. Worked a lot on just row crop management. Was the state specialist for sorghum and wheat up there, but worked a bulk majority of my time doing research in corn, soybean, and cotton. Opportunity came up to come back home, Oklahoma State. And really took advantage of that situation, came back originally as kind of more of an oilseed specialist, so canola and soybean and all that, but it's kind of morphed into a do whatever is available kind of situation. So we work a lot on grain sorghum, still a lot on soybean and canola, but corn. One thing that I've just been fascinated with my whole career is double crop systems and how kind of systems fit around our primary crop in the state, which is wheat. And so how can we work other crops besides wheat into a wheat-dominated system, especially when we start integrating cattle? And so that's kind of where we've kind of focused a lot of our time since we've been back here at Oklahoma State.
Perfect. So, you know, something very unique about what you do, and I want us to kind of dive deeper into that area, is double crop systems, double cropping systems, right? So I guess perhaps to begin with, since that is not something that is very common across the U.S. And perhaps other parts of the world where climate doesn't allow it, could you just describe what is a double cropping system? What makes it a double? Why is that word there? And how is that working in Oklahoma? What crops are you working those types of systems?
Yeah, so double crop systems are really a system to where we get to take advantage of weather that allows for us to harvest two crops in a year. And depending on kind of what you determine by harvest and kind of how you determine what a year is, you can see this work in various places that maybe wouldn't call it a double crop or whatnot. But a bulk majority of the time, you're talking about a harvest of two grain crops. So actually pulling grain off at two different times a year, typically in two different seasons. So in Oklahoma, or basically around the United States, the primary double crop system is going to be a winter small grain. So that normally is a wheat, but it could be an oat or a rye or a triticale or anything like that. And then we come in with a summer crop, typically soybean, and we grow soybean a little bit later in the summer, and therefore we harvest it a little bit later in the fall. And then kind of rotate back into that system with typically another summer crop the next year. In certain parts of the state and certain parts of the country, you can get back in with another winter crop, but you're mainly looking at a winter crop, summer crop back into either a fallow or another summer crop going back into that rotation. So it allows us to take advantage of what us in Oklahoma typically have, which are fairly good moisture in the fall. And it takes advantage of cooling conditions coming out of our summers that are really not available to really flesh out some summer crops. So even our normal planted or our full season soybean or corn can have issues with really hot temperatures and really dry conditions. What we do with double crop is, since we are delaying that planting of that summer crop until after we harvest wheat, we are kicking that summer crop a lot later to where it's going through some of its more critical growth stages in the fall rather than the summer, and therefore take advantage of our typically warmer falls, our wetter falls, and try to stay away from our really hot and dry summer conditions.
Perfect. That's a great overview of what that means. So you mentioned here that a wheat, soybean, and then followed by a summer crop again is probably the most common double cropping you would have. So that wheat, soybean system. Mm-hmm. Is that what you see most commonly in Oklahoma? Or, I mean, I guess, what other types of double cropping systems can you also grow in Oklahoma?
Yeah, so I mean, you can, your little heart's content is what you decide you want to grow. Like I said, still in Oklahoma, a bulk majority of the double crops is into soybean. We do have a fairly high amount of double crop into milo or grain sorghum. We've tried to dabble in other summer crops, but one we've really kind of dug into and really see some promise throughout the state is looking into double crop corn. And it's very unique. Even when I tell growers here in the state of Oklahoma, double crop corn, I still get funny looks. I don't know if you can double crop corn. The management's different compared to what you would traditionally look into a double crop system. When we talk about things like seeding rates, when we talk about planting time, planting conditions, and all that, it's very different on corn than we would get in our more traditional systems, or a more traditional double crop. So if you think of double crop as a unique system, double crop corn, which is something that we can do, and I think a lot of states could do, depending on kind of when their rainfall patterns are, is a unique system to a unique system, if you will.
Absolutely, because if we're thinking of a winter small grain followed by soybeans, I mean, you're really thinking of an extended time period to have those two crops in that double cropping system. But now, if you have a double crop corn system, they really have a narrower window of time that you can really grow those two corn crops, right? So how does that play into the success of this type of system? like how are you shifting planting dates, harvest dates, or even crop relative maturities to make sure that you can fit two corn crops into that growing season?
Well, and I will specify, I mean, when we're talking about double crop corn, we're still talking about wheat. We're still talking about a winter small grain and then growing into a summer corn. So that's still the system we're talking about. What we're doing is we're just manipulating that that summer crop to where instead of a soybean or instead of a grain sorghum, we're flipping that switch and moving into corn. So what in all reality, what we end up doing or what we end up seeing as compared to a traditional double crop soybean crop, that can be it still can be a very long system, but on our double crop corn to where we go wheat into corn, what we see is a very long system. So in our part of the world, we'll typically plant wheat depending on if you're going to graze the wheat or if you're not going to graze the wheat. So we'll plant wheat anywhere from September through November. And then that'll grow all winter into the spring. We will typically cut our wheat anytime from the first week of June through the first week in July. And so it's always a rush with our more traditional double crops, our soybeans and our grain sorghum, is that you want to get that crop in as quickly as you possibly can. Even if that means that you have the combine rolling through the field and you have a planter rolling 100 feet back of that combine, you're wanting to get that crop in as soon as possible. So in our part of the world where moisture is a main limitation, that can be an issue. We can see a failure of some of our double crop systems because we don't have the moisture in June. It's too hot and it's too dry in some years to even get that summer crop to establish. So what we do with the corn is we actually get flexibility to that system. And it's surprising how much flexibility we get. But if you think of when corn can grow, when we would typically plant corn and how much corn can grow, as long as we're continuing to develop heat units, we actually kick that corn planting back until July. And depending on where you are in the state, in Oklahoma, in my part of the world, so this north, central, northern Oklahoma on into like southern Kansas, we're moving that planting date back until, you know, we always tell growers that first rain after July 4th. And what we really want to do is make it to where we don't plant too early in the dry land systems, because moisture, again, is your limiting factor. And without the moisture, that corn crop's going to fail. In the southern part of the state, where we have a little bit more flexibility due to irrigation, but we also have an issue with diseases like southern rust. They go in just like you would in a double crop system, to where you would go in right after that wheat crop, because they can kind of sustain that corn crop during the hottest and driest part of the year, where the dry land needs it to be maturing more in August and September, not as much in July and August. So it still is with that small grain, and we do have some flexibility in planting date. But the interesting thing that I always tell folks that are interested in double crop corn is, yeah, I don't have to race the combine. That my planter is not rolling through the field for 3 or 4 weeks, so I have some flexibility to maybe let a couple rain showers hit and maybe recharge some of that soil moisture after the wheat crop before we really start getting hooked up with the corn crop.
Perfect. So you know, if we think here and compare the options a grower may have as far as either doing that winter small grain followed by a summer crop, in this case we're talking about corn, or maybe so the alternative would be, if a grower does not want to do double cropping, would be basically to just let it fallow until the next winter cereal planting time. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So if we think of those two systems side by side, what goes through the mind of a grower when they're thinking, okay, I want to do this or that? Like, what are the key components that they're thinking about on whether they should or could try a double crop system rather than just letting it fallow?
Yeah. So in a lot of decisions, especially here in Oklahoma, and you can probably even take in like southern Kansas and northern Texas as kind of that same decision making process. But a lot of the decision makings are going to revolve around wheat, you know, so it's going to be things like, markets of wheat. How does my wheat market look? How is my protein accumulation? Like, am I really getting low protein that I can't fix with more fertility, that it's just not the wheat's growing really well? Weeds and weed management is a big thing. And that's kind of where us in Oklahoma had kind of moved away from a bulk majority of our state, especially that north central part going into south central Kansas, and then that north central northwest Texas kind of has moved away from just continuous wheat, is because we have a ryegrass problem. And so your two options there are herbicide tolerant wheat, which depending on what the commodity market is, might be too expensive. The chemical might be expensive. And then we still have the issue with our wheat yields being stagnant without a crop rotation. Or, hey, I want to try to integrate some of these summer crops, but I still want wheat to my system, and I still want to have wheat as the dominant crop in my system. And so that's been kind of the fun part of my job in the last couple of years is working with growers that still want wheat. And I think it's, at least for the foreseeable future, with, you know, the importance of cattle in the state, and the value of wheat being such a hardy crop that's just so flexible for our environment, is that wheat's still going to be the primary crop or the pillar of the state. And so now it's let's give growers options to not just grow continuous wheat. Let's show them that maybe that herbicide tolerant wheat is not the best thing. They need just crop rotation and they can make things work. And so the biggest thing is just giving them options on saying, hey, you've grown wheat for 2 or 3 years, you're kind of stagnating on yield or maybe even going down. We have some options for you to get a 2 to 3 year cycle going to where you still can have a good amount of wheat. But after you get done planting maybe a double crop corn into a soybean, or maybe a double crop soybean into a corn, we can see not only do you get better grain yields, but you get better forage yields, and your ryegrass is a little bit easier to control because you've kind of been able to control it in a fallow system or in a crop that's a little easier to control grasses than wheat's been. So it's options. And as an extension specialist, I think that's been the biggest thing, is that you just tell yourself you're not replacing wheat. You're just providing growers options that if they feel like they're ready to go in to manage a summer crop, let's give them options that still involve and integrate a good amount of wheat that maybe are starting to integrate other crops into the system as well.
Man, I have so many thoughts going through my head here that I wanted to ask you, and just trying to parse through them, make sure I ask the most important ones.
And I think a really interesting part, if I can jump in here, and this is where people, so if you are familiar with double crop already, right? So if you're doing double crop soybean, something along those lines, double crop milo, you think the later planting, I'm going to get less growth, right? I mean, that is just inherently what we work through in double crop systems all the time. And so we overcome that with seeding rate, right? So I, instead of 90,000 soybean plants per acre, I'm going to plant 120, or instead of 120, I'm going to plant 150, or what have you. I'm going to usually take that rule of thumb and plant 20% more on my double crop than I do my single crop, as a means to overcome the fact that you're missing a couple of months. The interesting thing with corn is you don't change any of that. Mm. We ran several trials and we got zero benefit. Actually, we saw a decrease the higher we went. So in all actuality, if you're going to change seeding rate, you want to go down and let that corn flex out a little bit, have a little bit more area underneath it to get into that water. So us in Oklahoma, we're already fairly low in our population. We were talking about our low pop mafia we have in the state, but getting down to sub 20,000 seeds per acre on soybean or on corn, we just don't change it. It doesn't change. And so whenever you think in yourself, management, how do I manage a double crop corn separately than I would a full season corn? We shift a little bit away from fertility. We actually get by with a little bit less fertility. But we want still about the same, if not a little bit less nitrogen. We typically don't get the value on seed treatment in double crop than we do in full season. And that's in Oklahoma. Everybody in the podcast, I am speaking in Oklahoma only, but we don't have the disease pressure that some other places do. And especially when we're planting in July or late June, we don't have the need for seed treatment from a disease management standpoint. But what we do kind of flip that money over to is weed control, because we are still going to have smaller plants. Those plants are going to be smaller. And so we're going to have to overcome that with spending more money on weed control than we would some of our other things. So that's kind of the fun thing that we always talk about on double crop corn is you treat it like full season corn. You just are planting it a couple months later.
That's a great compliment, I guess, to what you were talking about. And, you know, so we mentioned here moisture being like, so you want to plant after that first rain after July 4th. So you invest less in fertility, perhaps you invest less on seed costs. So those are two of the major costs in ag production right there. You may have to invest more in weed control. And I'm thinking here, perhaps one of the other pillars that I'm curious if you have to adapt or not is your relative maturity. So are you changing that based on compared to a full season corn crop, or is it still the same?
Yeah, when I'll put the caveat here is that we normally grow somewhere between 110, 112 day to 119 day corn, just normally. And so our relative maturity, the first thing that goes through people's mind is, well, I need to go down to something like a 90 day corn, you know, because I am up against the wall and I really need to get finished. But our response to that is that's not what our data has seen. Our data has really seen you just. When I say you manage it the same, you manage it the same. So if you like 119 day corn and that's what works for you and you got a variety that works, that's what's worked for us. I think the only big caveat that we have on that is we can make short corn, the short stature corn, work in full season because it's inherently less biomass. We can't make that work for double crop. I've yet to get a variety of short stature corn that works relatively well. But most of the time, if we get a good corn hybrid that's going to work full season, that same corn hybrid is going to work double crop. The biggest thing is that your harvest is just late, and it is sometimes very late. we often will cut after Thanksgiving, you know, so later part of November into December. We've cut two of the last 5 years, we've cut it in January. And that's because that it kind of still matures out in October or so, very similar to what our normal double crops do in the state. But the dry down period is much slower. And so our being able to get corn down to really get it sub 20% moisture is very challenging. The same value we get in higher humidity, more consistent rainfalls, which is why we're trying this double crop corn in the fall, is also what spikes our both our plant and our seed moisture. And so, like, you know, we've been asked a lot, have you tried desiccants? And it's like, oh yeah, I mean, I can dry down the plant, you know, I can go through over the top and put a desiccation, but it's not going to make that seed dry down any faster. And our seed dry down is often a step slower than our plant dry down, because a good frost will dry that plant down, but we still could lock in 20% moisture on that seed really until it decides that it wants to finish out. So sometimes we need a good freeze to kill the plant, and then we need some good winds, and then a hot week in January, and that's when we'll pull the trigger on harvesting. So it's really pushed our management mind on, like, not only harvest management but post-harvest management. We're lucky in the state, we got peanut dryers, so we got old dryers. But I mean, if you go up to the Midwest, you talk about old silo dryers. Something that's got forced hot air is going to help dry that down. But more often than not, we have to cut it a little wet really late in the year, and then hopefully we can get it dry off the plant or out of the field.
Perfect. Now this is really interesting. So if we you know, of course, those are different systems, so you would expect a difference there. But just for context, what would be a good average yield potential you get out of your full season corn compared to your double crop corn?
Well, and I will say I'm in dry land Oklahoma. So for anybody that's listening, I grew corn in the Southeast, and you know, you have to temper expectations for dry land in Oklahoma. So normally dry land in Oklahoma, especially this part of the world, you know, you're looking at 120, you know, anywhere from probably 100 to 130 bushel. You know, we can have some years where we sneak up to 150 and what have you. But if you think about that 110 to 120 as being kind of right there in the median of where we can expect dry land corn in Oklahoma to be, that's kind of where we're at. It would be the expectation of anywhere between 75 and like 95 bushel corn. So we are set back a little bit. You know, we do go down in yield, especially where we have a good summer. We will lose some yield on the double crop, but you know, it's not that bad. And the consistency is more what we're looking for. So we're trying to get that moisture in. And, you know, while we're going through pollination, while we're going through seed fill and finishing out that crop, is we'll get better conditions typically in September than we will July or June. So, you know, it's that consistent we're trying to shoot for. Of course, Mother Nature can be an issue. I mean, we've had ice storms in August and, you know, snowstorms in November, and that kind of throws a wrench in everything. But that throws a wrench in most of your double crop systems. That's not exclusive to corn, but you still got a long season in front of you if you get a really cold snap in October. I mean, you're still over a month out of potentially even thinking about harvesting. So you're still pre-black layer typically at first part of October. It, you know, really, really rough fall conditions can be detrimental to that yield potential. But what we're looking for is a lower yield potential, but more consistent yield across the years.
Nice, nice. That's fantastic. Well, if you're listening to us and you're enjoying this conversation, make sure you drop us a like, follow our podcast across different platforms, whichever one you're using to listen to us, and also share this episode with anyone you think could benefit as well.
It's time for our famous three.
All right, so Josh, we're getting towards the end of our episode here. We have our three last questions that we ask every guest. So the first one here is, if you have any favorite resource from the ag side, so crop soils, whatever it is that you may have, that you use that a lot and you think would be a good resource to share with our audience as well.
Okay, so I'm going to cheat a little bit on this because I think going through my career, I was of great value to be able to have Dr. Bill Ron as a resource, and talk about a man with technical prowess till no end, and he was a great resource, so I will have to say that he has helped shape a lot of the technical aspects. And that man still has recorded lectures online. So if you want a true education in soil fertility, all you got to do is go to his website, and he still has his lectures posted online. So it's a good one. The other thing that I really like, I'm a big fan of these podcast type. I mean, that kind of gets you intrigued on the technical thing or the technical potential, and then you can kind of follow rabbit trails down and you know, get to research papers or what have you. One that I do like is Crop Docs. I do believe is the name of the podcast out of Mississippi. Those guys, Alan and those guys there are top notch, man. Those guys know their stuff. And me being an old Delta agronomist, I'm a big fan of hearing what's going on in the Delta still. So those kind of things and these podcasts here, I really find my technical information. I'm more of a millennial than I am anything else. So I like my technology to get me my technical information. So podcasts and the YouTube stuff are kind of where I can get. But you know, seeing seeing my colleagues just put on things is just outstanding. I really like seeing my colleagues doing what they're doing out in the field. That really helps spur my technical intrigued, if you will, to go and follow that, to go find the research papers or books or something like that they've written on it.
Absolutely. And, you know, in my career and to this day, I work in sensor-based nutrient management. And for those that are listening that may not be working in this area or may not have heard of Bill Rahn, wow, what a researcher and fantastic person. So, you know, it's really great that you bring up his name and all the resources and all the things that he produced. And it's definitely a great one to be looking up to.
Yeah. Yeah. He's actually the only reason why I went and got a PhD. He's the only one that believed in me whenever I was an undergrad. So that man is the reason I'm sitting in this chair still here today. So I don't think anybody that interacted with Bill Rahn in his lifetime, you know, can say that he didn't impact them in some way, shape or form.
Yeah, I had, so when I was doing my PhD in Nebraska, Bill Rahn went up to Lincoln to interview for the department head position that we had open. And at the time I was chaperoning him around different meetings, and it was really the first time that I interacted in person with him. And it was just for, you know, maybe a couple hours that day. And still I remember like so many little things that he did that day. Like, you know, one that I cannot forget was we're just walking through from our agronomy building to the student center, and we were just walking and talking, going from one minute to the next, and he just said, "Hold on, Leo." He stopped me, and then he went back and picked up trash from the floor and then went in and put it inside of a trash can. And I'm like, and I'm looking at him, I'm like, I have never seen anyone doing this ever. Well, anyways, it was such a small thing, but that calls your attention to such a degree, because it's not something that you know, you see every day. And it was just such a small act of him being himself. And I mean, of course, that's just such a small thing, but so many more small things that they happen that I'm like, man, this is a special person. It's beyond his research career.
And a renowned scientist that cared about students as much as he did. I mean, he saw that students in the university were the future of agriculture. And if we didn't foster those students, you know, we weren't going to have agriculture, you know, because the old timers that had all this institutional knowledge eventually were going to retire or pass away. And he's like, it's time for the students to really get the keys to the kingdom, if you will. So he was always so pro-student. He loved his students, loved his kids. You know, like I said, you just can't help but admire that man as a research scientist and what all he's done for the field.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was just, you know, something very small. And of course, Bill is, I guess, from those that don't get to interact with him personally, he's so the biggest, perhaps, name in sensor-based nutrient management in the world. So it's such an important person, yet so humble and so so caring for others. So that was really, really special person. All right. So our next question here is similar, but a little bit different. So what type of resource have you come across outside of the technical side? So perhaps, you know, something more on the personal development side, or really anything outside of agronomy that you've come across, you think is really useful, and you'd like to share with our audience as well.
You know, this was the hardest question, and I will have to say, for you listeners, I got thrown on the spot on this question coming, and I didn't have kind of areas to prep. I don't know. Like, it's really hard for me to kind of just sit back and from a professional standpoint, kind of think of things that have helped me grow in a non-technical sense. And just, you know, for to break the fourth wall on the next question that's coming, I will kind of blend these two together. But I really think I've gained the most on like understanding how to do this thing called science and this thing called agriculture on just human interaction. And I'm big extension, you know, I do 65% of my job is extension. And so it's just got a human element to it. So whether it be my colleagues or my growers or anything along those lines, that's kind of my best resource. And have an intrigue and interest in what folks are doing and learning from them. If you got students that are going through, you know, their bachelor's, their master's, or PhD listening, the amount of information you can gain from a grower that's been at this for 30 years is, I will tell you, it's more than I can give you in a classroom. So, you know, those human connections are one of those things that from a non-technical aspect, not really answering your question because I don't have a good answer for your question. and it's a cheating answer, but I've never been big on like the self-help things and you know, that personal improvement through books or anything like that. But talking to people to be a better person, be a better scientist, be a better agronomist is just where I've learned the most from.
Nice. No, that's a great answer. I mean, you know, it's not something that somebody can really go out and watch or read, yet is a very, very important source of.
But yet it's something that everybody can do. Like, yes, you don't have to find it. All you got to do is just listen.
Yeah.
And I'm the kind of guy that sits in a corner and just listens to people talk because I learn more from listening than running my mouth. So just listen to folks. You know, you never know what you're going to learn.
Nice. Well, you know, I guess that may spill over our next question then, which is totally fine. But so what, you know, from your, now our next and last question of the episode, we always ask our guests what types of skills or skill sets you've observed in successful people around you. So I guess you're probably going to answer, you know, communication and some people skills, but if you can just perhaps elaborate on that as well.
When I think people, sometimes people have people skills, but they don't have the altruistic nature, the empathy to listen to people, because it's more than just being able to interact well with people, but being able to take something what somebody says really to heart. You know, there's a good line in a song a long time ago is that, you know, you take everybody's opinion and then you decide what's valuable. You know, it's up to you to kind of digest that, but listening to everybody. And so it's having that empathy and that altruism enough to actually give people your attention when you are interacting with them, because that's super important. And I do a lot with students. You know, I usually have at least 4 to 6 students, graduate students, all at one point in time. And, you know, listen to them. You know, their questions are very humbling sometimes because they're leagues ahead of where we think they should be. So, you know, that people skills, being able to interact and talk with folks, you know, that's not on your cell phone, and being able to look somebody in the eye and talk to them is really valuable. But then being able to shut your mouth sometimes and listen and really listen to somebody and what they're saying and hear kind of where they're coming from, has really helped in ag, because like I said, sometimes people make decisions from the heart and not from the head. And you have to take that into account whenever you're making recommendations, whether that be life recommendations or agriculture recommendations, is you have to take piece of people's personal situation and circumstance into account. Don't just spew facts. It's kind of what I've done in my life, whether that's been successful or not. It's not for me to judge, but we'll see at the end of my time if we talk about me as much as they do Bill, but that's kind of how I've strived. I mean, that's, you listen to the things that I say for that. And that's kind of what he instilled. So
yeah.
Hate to go back to that well, but I never will stop going back to the Bill Ron well, is that he was the model of what I think a lot of people should be.
Nice. That's really great. Well, with that, we wrap up our episode for today. So Josh, it was a really great pleasure to have you here. I learned a lot about double cropping, especially in Oklahoma. And also just from, you know, our conversation here, really learning a lot about other things. And, you know, as you just said, I really, really enjoy hearing more about, you know, your personal connection with Bill Ron and how he has and will for sure continue to shape a lot of people through his legacy. So thanks for all the conversation. Really enjoyed it. It was great having you.
Oh, I mean, thanks for the opportunity. I never turned down an opportunity to come chat.
Sounds great.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.